God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It is melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him, those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it.
All right, good morning. Thank you so much for being here in worship with us today. So one of the things that you need to know about me is that I really do not like horror movies. I think the last horror film I went to see was The Blair Witch Project back in the late 90s. If you're too young to have a clue what I'm talking about, let me save you the $3.99 that you would pay to rent that thing and stream it and watch it on Amazon or whatever. Do not get it. More importantly, let me save you the 90 minutes of your life that you would waste watching that movie. I have basically written off all horror movies. And one of the reasons I have is that I've just grown weary of the same old plot line that they have in every horror movie. I mean, you've watched them before. You understand how it works. It begins, and there's a group of people. They're camping in the woods, and it's nighttime, and they're sitting around the campfire, and suddenly they hear some strange noise in the woods. What happens? Every time, a guy says, "Let me go investigate." "Well, Bill, would you like one of us to go with you?" "No, no, no, I'll go by myself to check out this noise." "Well, would you like to take a flashlight?" "Sure, let me get the one where the batteries are just about to go out. That's the one I'll take." And you know, you're watching the movie, and what do you instinctly do? "Well, Bill's dead." I mean, that's the first guy that's going to die, right? You just know it. You know, or they're all sitting around in a living room somewhere, and they're watching this report that's on the news late at night about a serial killer who's just escaped from prison, and then they hear a noise outside. What happens? Joe says, "Let me go check it out." "Joe, would you like to take a gun with you?" "No, no, no, I'm sure it's nothing. I'll go unarmed." You're watching the movie. What do you say? "Joe's dead." "Yeah, we know. Joe, you're done. You're going to be the first guy that dies." I mean, one of the things that I hate about these movies is no one in the movie seems to understand the buddy system. And it just doesn't make sense. Well, I guess it doesn't make sense unless you're the writer of a horror movie. Because then it makes perfect sense. The guy or the girl being alone adds to the fear as much as the guy with the hockey mask and chainsaw. I mean, it's just scary to be alone, right? None of us like to be alone, especially when we're facing scary circumstances. Today, we are continuing Psalms, and we're covering Psalm 22. Psalm 22 was written by David, who is the second king over Israel, the writer of almost half of the Psalms. And it was written by David during a very scary low point in his life. We don't know exactly what was going on. We don't have the exact details of the background, but we know that there were a couple of things that were true about David's situation. Number one, it was severe suffering that he was going through. The first thing that we know is that this was more than just a casual kind of suffering. I mean, sometimes we'll complain about life, but it's not really suffering. You know, like, "Hey, my favorite football team lost yesterday, and it's just awful, and I'm suffering right now." Or, you know, "This restaurant I love, they're closing down, and it's just awful." And we'll say things like, you know, "It's just the worst." it's the worst that all this has happened. Well, you know, pretty much it's first world problems. And on the suffering scale of life, it's just, you know, it's not that big of a deal. That's not what David was going through. David was more than your average run-of-the-mill suffering. David was going through very difficult circumstances. Other thing that we know is, based on what we read in the psalm, is that David felt all alone. That David felt so alone that he even felt abandoned by God. That he was all by himself, completely, with no one by his side, to help out. Now, I happen to believe there's no evidence that, you know, tells us exactly what David was going through, but I happen to believe that he wrote this particular psalm during a time in his life when he really was alone. I think he happened to write this during a period where he was on the run from Saul, the first king over Israel. Saul wanted David dead. David was on the run, and David had a small army with him. Army is really an overstatement. It was a band of guys who were, you know, sort of like a militia, who were loyal to David, and they were helping David run from King Saul and to fight these various battles. At some point, the hometown of David and all of these fighting men was raided by these evil people called the Amalekites. And the Amalekites destroyed this town, and then they took all the wives and children of these men, including David, and they carried them off into some other place, to their home, and held them hostage. David and his men discovered this. They come upon their town, it's burned down, they learn that all these guys have been carried off, and obviously they are distraught. I mean, their families have been carried away, their homes are burned, you know, what do we do? They are distraught, but for David it got even worse. Because all of these men, it was about 600 men, all of these men began to blame David. As the leader, they said, David, this is your fault. And we don't know if David made a decision to leave their hometown and go and fight some battle or exactly why they blamed David. But for whatever reason, they blamed David, and it got pretty intense. Just to understand the intensity of the situation, 1 Samuel 30 says this: David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. I mean, that's bad. I would be distressed as well. If people are talking about stoning me, they are more than a little mad. And so David at this point felt all alone. These men who had been by his side, who had been loyal to him, suddenly they turn on him and they forgot David had suffered as well. David's family had been carried off. David has lost his home as well. But on top of that, all of his friends had turned and they were talking about killing him. And that's how bad it was. Now, ultimately, they didn't do it. We're not sure exactly what happened, but cooler heads prevailed, and David ended up leading these men to go after the Amalekites. They wiped out the Amalekites. They rescued their family. The end of the story ended well, but for a period of time, David felt all alone. And during that time, he found something to write on, and he found something to write with, and he sat down, and he wrote out this poem or this psalm that we now call Psalm 22. If you've got a Bible, you can turn there. We're not going to read the entire thing. It's fairly long, but I want us to look at several key verses that are found in this psalm. Start with verse 1. David wrote, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish?" I mean, get the deep emotion that David is expressing here. Because all of his friends have turned on him, because he feels all alone. This has bled over so that he even feels that God has abandoned him. He even feels that God has forsaken him. Now, later in this psalm, it changes. But at this point for David, his emotions are overruling what he knows to be true. At this point in his life, His emotions are lying to him, and he has believed that God has abandoned him. Now, later in the psalm, those two link together, and David comes to his senses and his emotions and what he knows to be true line up. But at this point, his emotions have overruled what he knows. Okay, skip down to verse 7. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. So a couple of things here. David is saying, look, everyone who sees me, they mock me, they insult me. And the second thing is, they do so at least in part because of his faith in God. Now, we're not sure why, but because of his trust in God, they are hurling insults at David. Very well could have been that David told his men, the reason that we are to leave our home is because God has told me to go and fight this battle over here. And now they're saying, God told you? You're that close to God? Well, if you're that close to God, then let God save you now. If they had him locked in some kind of prison or something, they just mocked him and said, hey, see what this guy can do for you now. Skip down to verse 14. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It is melted within me. My mouth is dried up like potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. Here, David uses very graphic, very strong, metaphorical language to describe his situation. By the way, back then, dogs were not man's best friend. Dogs were scavengers. They were wild beasts, and the way that they survived was to feed on the carcasses of dead animals. They were like vultures. So here, David is saying, dogs have surrounded me because they see that I'm about to die. And so perhaps I'm their next meal. People are dividing my clothes because what use does a dead man have for clothing? And so they're already, picking my clothes, what they're going to take. David uses this strong language to describe the suffering that he's going through. Then go down to verse 27. Somehow, in David's heart and in David's mind, everything changes. His perspective changes, and what he talks about here in this psalm changes its tone. He says, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to dust will kneel before him, those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. So here David says about his situation that there's some future time that God's going to take the situation and use it for good, and people will talk about this particular suffering that he is going through, and generations to come, people yet to be born, will praise God because of what David is going through. And strangely, what David does is, instead of just focusing on his situation, he points to and predicts this future event where God will do something big. There are two things this psalm is about. The first is this future act of God. If you've not picked up on it yet, Psalm 22 is a perfect description of Jesus dying on the cross. If you don't see it yet, we're going to walk through it and explain it. But David, 1,000 years before Jesus Christ was born, and hundreds of years before this torture death penalty method called crucifixion had been invented, David described perfectly not only what happens during a crucifixion to the condemned, but what happened specifically to Jesus when he was crucified. If you ever have this point in your life where you start to wonder, well, is all of this real? Did God really write the Bible? Is this inspired by God? Or are these just stories and verses that are made up by men? You know, is all of this really from God? If you ever have moments like that, here's what I want you to do. Go sit down and read Psalm 22. There is no way that David could have even imagined what a crucifixion was at this point. And yet he sits down, and because God is guiding his hand, he perfectly describes a crucifixion and specifically the crucifixion of Jesus. Let's walk through and see just how amazing this is and how when you read this, you see how God has had this plan from the beginning and how the Bible syncs together so well and just how incredible it is that David was able to write these words. So let's look at several verses. The first one is this. David wrote, "I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint." Now, just to give you a little bit of historical perspective, crucifixion was invented by the Persians sometime around 400 BC, but it was perfected and widely used by the Romans. We get the English word excruciating from the word crucifixion to signify something that is slow and painful. It is arguably the most painful form of execution that has ever been dreamed up by the human mind. It is the most awful, horrible, horrendous way to die. The condemned would be forced to carry the crossbar, the horizontal bar, to the place of execution. They would lay him on the ground, and then they would drive 7-inch nails through his wrists. Now, I know the Bible says hands, but in the Greek, hands include the wrist. And so they would drive these nails through the wrist, striking the median nerve, which would shoot soaring, severe pain throughout the body. And then the condemned would be lifted, and that bar placed on the vertical bar, so that the individual would hang there from that bar. If you've ever seen Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, it is a good description, portrayal of what happened during crucifixion. So when the person would hang from those nails by their wrist bones, what would happen is their wrist bones and their shoulder bones would be pulled out of joint. As they were pulled out of joint, the person would actually lengthen. In fact, most articles I read said the average condemned person, that from their shoulder to their hands, it would lengthen by 6 inches during this time. When David wrote these words, "I am poured out like water and all my bones are out of joint," it described perfectly what happened during a crucifixion. Next thing that he wrote is, "My heart has turned to wax. It is melted within me." So the condemned person would be placed onto this vertical bar, and then they would take the feet and they would nail the feet to that vertical bar. For a person to get air into their lungs, they would have to push up with their feet onto that nail, which is, you can imagine, was extremely painful. As they hung there, unable to get air into their lungs, fluid would begin to build up around their lungs and around their heart. This most often would cause a cardiac arrest, and in some cases would actually cause the heart to rupture because of all the pressure from the fluid that was placed on the heart. Most condemned criminals died from a heart attack. They could have died from a ruptured heart or a heart that felt like it had melted, that just burst during the crucifixion. David also wrote, "My mouth is dried up like potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death." So understand, when Jesus was crucified, when any criminal was crucified, they would lay them on the ground in the dust to nail their hands to that crossbar and then lift them up. And David here says, "You've laid me in the dust of death. My mouth is dried up." Anyone dying by crucifixion would be extremely thirsty as as they hung there in the sun for hours. In fact, we know as painful as it was for Jesus to speak, he spoke, and one of the things that he said was simply, "I am thirsty." And those standing around took this wine vinegar and they put it on a sponge and they lifted it up to the lips of Jesus because he cried out, "I am thirsty." David wrote, "Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet." Now, what was going on with David at this point? We don't know exactly how he portrayed his own situation as having his hands and his feet pierced. We don't know. He could have just felt trapped. And so he used this language to describe that they had him pinned down, that he was trapped, that he couldn't go anywhere, that he was being held hostage. But what he didn't know that we now know is that he was perfectly describing what happened during the crucifixion process. He also wrote, "They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment." So they take my clothes and they divide those, and you get this, and you get this, and you get this. But then the garment, the most expensive piece, they roll the dice to see who would get that. What need does David have for clothing? If he's dying, they can divide up his clothing. Exact same thing happened to Jesus. Here's what Matthew said. When they crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The soldiers at the foot of the cross, the dying condemned man, had no more use for his clothes. And so they took his clothes and they cast lots to see who would get the outer garment, the most expensive piece. "All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads." And again, David's describing his situation as people just hurl insult after insult at him for their situation where they are having to figure out what to do about their homes being destroyed and their families being taken off. The same thing happened to Jesus. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads. In verse 8, "He trusts in the Lord, let him deliver him, for he delights in him." And again, David, you know, we don't know exactly why, but they were mocking David for his trust in God. And we know that's what they did to Jesus. The chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, very sarcastically, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe as well." And Jesus, who displayed this incredible faith in God, now they're saying, "Well, let's see if that God can save you now." And then go back up to verse 1. David wrote, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And again, we talked about how David just felt alone. He felt abandoned by God. He felt like he had no one, including God, to turn to. We know that Jesus said the same thing from the cross. About 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, Jesus spoke in Aramaic. That was the language they used then. And so Matthew here decides to record the Aramaic and then give the translation, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, here's what you need to understand. You and I call this Psalm 22. During this time, they didn't refer to this as Psalm 22. They refer to all of the Psalms by the first line of the Psalm. In fact, next week, we're going to look at Psalm 23. They did not call it Psalm 23. They called it "The Lord is My Shepherd" Psalm. They just refer to each of the Psalms by the first line of the Psalm. Now, here's the other thing you need to know. At this point, the vast majority of people did not have their own personal copy of the Scriptures. 99% of the people did not have their own personal copy of the Scriptures. The only way you had your personal copy is if you were super, super rich, or you were one of the priests working in the temple. You just did not have access to the Scriptures. The way you learned the Scriptures, or the way you could use the Scriptures, was to memorize the Scriptures and to memorize them from what you heard in the synagogue. And so the average Jewish person would memorize long passages of Scripture so they could recall those passages whenever they needed to. and especially the Psalms, because the Psalms were recited, and in many cases they were sung in worship. As they would go to the synagogue, the Psalms were used as part of their liturgy. And so the average Jewish person had Psalm 22 memorized. So when Jesus on the cross said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" the average Jewish person standing there at the foot of the cross would have heard that line, and they would have thought immediately about Psalm 22. And they would have begun the process of running through the verses in that psalm. And they would have gone, Psalm 22, the people surround me, the dogs surround me, they're casting lots for my clothing, and they pierce my hands and my feet. And they would have gone through all of that, and they would have gone, what? Wait, David wrote that 1,000 years ago about his situation, but it's perfectly describing. And at some point they would have said, maybe Jesus is exactly who he said he is. And maybe this was something that God had planned from the very beginning. So here we see David writing these words. Jesus spoke from the cross. Jesus was referring back to this entire prophecy about himself. And finally, go all the way to the end, to verse 31. David said, "They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it." David says this situation, this suffering is going to be used for good, and people will talk about this for generations to come. Nations will talk about this. And Jesus very much echoed this same sentiment from the cross when he said, "It is finished." With that, he bowed down and bowed his head and gave up his spirit. I mean, David very much was saying, look, something's going to happen in the future where people will say he has done it. And Jesus here said, "It is complete. It is done." That this act of God for humanity has been completed. And here David gives this prediction that in Christ is fulfilled, so that 2,000 years later, all around the world, in nations all around the world, people proclaim to be followers of Christ and talk about his crucifixion and what God did. The first thing about Psalm 22 that we have to understand is that it is about God's plan from the beginning. And it is this beautiful, incredibly accurate prophecy about what would happen to Jesus on the cross. But it's more than that. It is also about our individual suffering. It also speaks to us when we feel like we are all alone, and when we feel like God has abandoned us. Maybe some of you right now, you feel like that. I mean, you're in this dark place. You feel like David. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why am I all by myself? Why have these people surrounded me? Why are they out for me? And right now, you feel absolutely alone and abandoned. What do you do? What do you do during these dark nights of the soul? Let me give you a few things. This is on your notes page. Four things that we need to remember when we're going through these difficult times. The first is this: don't waste your waiting. If you feel like, hey, you know, God doesn't hear me right now, and you know, I'm not saying that he's forsaken me, but he's off doing something else and he's really not paying attention to me. If you feel like that and you're in this holding pattern, don't waste that time. Use this time as you wait on God to prepare for whatever it is that God has for you. In fact, 1 Peter speaks to it this way. He says, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you." I love that line, that he may lift you up in due time. That even in this suffering, even in this waiting, that God will, in his time, lift you up and bring a resolution to this situation. About 20 years ago, I remember going through one of these just dark times in my life. I was single back then, and there were just, you know, nothing major, but all these kind of struggles that I was facing. And it was just one of these times, I wouldn't have said that God had abandoned me, but I just felt like God wasn't really speaking to me. And there was just this disconnect, and I felt very much alone. And at some point, I said, okay, I've got to do something about this. I mean, I've got to take some serious action. And so, again, I was single at the time. I was living by myself at the time. And so I made this commitment that every day I was going to get up early, and I was going to spend 1 hour reading my Bible and praying. An hour every morning before I started my day, I was going to read my Bible and pray. And I read a whole lot of books during that time, books on spiritual disciplines, books just, you know, devotional books about how to grow closer to God. And I remember I didn't have internet. I made the decision to not have internet at my house. I had it in my office so I could go to pay bills or, you know, book a plane ticket, whatever you have to do on the internet. Like, I had access to it, but I didn't have it at my house. I had a television, but no DVD player. I just decided I was not going to waste this time by vegging out on television and movies. And so did all that I could to just draw closer to God. It was almost 2 years that I was in this period. What I did not know at the time, what I figured out later and could only really know in retrospect, was that I was getting ready to enter into this whirlwind season of my life. You know, Katie and I started dating, and we got married, and then we moved overseas, and then we moved back here to this church so I could pastor this church, and then we had a child, and then right after that we had another child, and then we started fostering, and then we adopted a child, and then we adopted right after that another child, and there was just all this whirlwind of activity going on. And I would not, for all of these years, have that kind of margin in my life again. And in fact, going back to that period of my life, that's the last time I actually had the freedom to spend that much time with the Lord. And I've calculated it, and I've got about another 15 years before I'll have that time to do that again. But God took that time and said, hey, I need to prepare you for this next phase of your life. Whatever it is that you're going through, don't waste it. Do not waste your waiting. Second thing is this: when you feel abandoned by God, remember the past. Remember those times when you felt close to God. Remember those times where God seemed to be right there next to you, as close as your next breath. I mean, maybe go back to your salvation experience, or go back to some moment where you were praying and praying and praying and you saw God answer your prayer. Go back to some moment in your life and say, God, I remember what you did in the past and how faithful you were. There's a story in the book of Joshua about the Israelites going into the promised land, and they get to the Jordan River, and it's at flood stage, and you know, it's couple million people, and they cannot get across the Jordan River. It's just, you know, the waters are too high. And they're like, hey, what do we do now? And God says to Joshua, here's what I want you to tell the people. I want you to get the priest, to get the ark, and you guys go and stand in the river. And when you stand in the river with the ark, it will block the waters. And that's exactly what happened. The waters quit flowing. All these people were able to get across and to go into the promised land. And then after that event, here's what God said to the people of Israel. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And so in the future, when your children maybe are doubting God or doubting God's faithfulness, point to that altar. Point to that marker and say, let me tell you how good God was to us. Let me tell you the story of God's faithfulness. If you're doubting, here, remember what God did for Israel. We need to do the same in our lives. You know, maybe it's something that somebody gave you when you were baptized, and that's your marker. And you can go, you know, I remember, and God was so real, and I know that God will be faithful. Maybe it's a picture of when you were on some kind of mission team and on this trip, and all of you were working towards this common goal, and you can remember how close you felt, and you saw God work, and you're like, oh, that was the most amazing time. Go back to one of those markers in your life and go, yes, God, you were faithful in the past, and you'll be faithful as well in the future. Number three, make a decision. At some point when you're discouraged, it's so easy to get bogged down in all the emotions and in all the circumstances, but at some point say, God, I'm not going to let this ruin my life and my relationship with you. And God, in spite of what I'm going through, I'm going to continue to pursue you. Again, the book of Joshua at the very end, there's this part where Joshua draws a line in the sand and says to the people of Israel, make a decision. Who are you going to serve? Other gods? Are you going to serve the God of Israel? And here's what he said. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And at some point you say, God, I'm not going to let this ruin my relationship with you. I'm going to continue to serve you. Even when everything around me is falling apart, I'm going to focus on you. And then finally, here's the last thing. Get ready for God's blessings. Get ready for God's blessings. If you are a follower of Christ, listen carefully to me, then right now, it may seem awful. If you're a follower of Christ, right now, maybe it's Friday in your life. But guess what? Sunday is coming. Because if you're a follower of Christ, Sunday is always coming. How can I say that? Because of Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. As a follower of Christ, whatever situation you're in right now, God is using that in some way. And as dark as it seems right now, God has something for you. And so as dark as it is, as much of a struggle as it is, remember this. Two things. One, the God that you serve understands suffering because He suffered as well. We just went through the description of what Jesus endured on the cross. We serve a God who very much understands suffering. He sees every tear that you shed, every bit of pain you experience. God understands that because He has suffered as well. And the other thing that you need to know is the same God who rescued David and who raised Jesus from the dead will redeem your situation as well.